So we've been looking at some online strange conspiracy theory type situations involving computers that are apparently haunted. So we thought that as computer scientists, computer experts, particularly ones that understand hacking, it might be a good idea to look at some of those famous cases, including one that's quite modern, and actually give our own sort of spin on it from a computer science perspective to find out if the computer or device is hacked or haunted.
Well, what do you think, Helen? Are there spooky goings on? Perturbations on the astral plane? Spectral infestations in our computers? Or is it all explainable with science and reason?
Well, apparently, according to one of them, it's about your intentions and it's how you're messing with the quantum reality and quantum consciousness. But as a scientist, I just look at the code and I like to look at their settings and things like that and kind of come up with a different way of looking at it, which is quite interesting. So we should probably dive on into some of those.
Yeah. Have you ever had an alpha waves day?
What's an alpha wave day?
It's where you wake up and the first thing that happens is you blow up the toaster. And then after that, from that point on, anything technical that you touch or even go near, that's the end of it. And if you call someone on the phone will break. If you go near a computer, the whole hard drive will need reformatting.
I've had days like that. Usually it happens in threes, doesn't it? One thing breaks, three things break, and I'm like, God damn it, so expensive.
I think if you've already destroyed three gadgets and it's not even lunchtime, then you're definitely having an alpha waves day. Just step away from the keyboard and don't even look at anything that uses electricity.
That's hilarious. But I don't think this is an alpha wave situation. I believe that one of them is people finding coincidences in things that are quite random. And that's how it's being sold. And we'll talk about that. And that's the app Random Nautica. And we're going to look at the Donaldson messages, which has been around for about 35 years. And it has hours and hours of online YouTube stuff. There's been 35 paranormal investigations. There's even a book that costs £160 secondhand by Mr. Ken himself, which we'll get to know in a short while. And it's quite interesting because we look at these and there's loads of Reddit groups on this as well. And there's people who generally believe that a computer or the messages on a computer are from ghosts, which wow. Are quite surprising.
£160?
I know, right?
So nobody's exploiting anybody's gullibility here.
No. And of course, the man who wrote that book and is making that money is actually the victim in all of this and was also the owner of the BBC Model B computer. But it's okay, because don't worry, there was this whole deleted data incident, which we'll get to, which means that he couldn't have been him at all. It had to be a ghost. And we'll look at that in a second, because that's the real computer science bit there.
So, a haunted BBC Model B.
I don't know much about a BBC Model B. Do you remember a BBC Model B, Andy, ever played around?
That's what I learned basic on in about 1982.
Amazing. So, maybe for our younger listeners, you should explain a BBC Model B for our listeners.
It's like a cheese-shaped door wedge.
You know, is it like a Chromebook? Is it an Apple? Is it like a phone?
No, it was about the size of a small suitcase and had a 6502 microprocessor. So kind of fairly slow by today's standards.
They were rolled out to schools, right, across the UK. So I think that we had like this weird, gigantic sort of cream Apple sort of thing. It had an Apple symbol on it, but I think that was a BBC because it was part of the school programme. We'd have one, like, in the classroom, and we got to go and play some text-based game on it that stealthily or not so stealthily taught you sort of maths and English.
I think you'll find that the Apple was actually an acorn.
Was it an acorn? Yes, it was an acorn. I remember that's the first time that someone told me not to do something on a computer and I did it anyway to see what would happen.
Story of our lives.
And I got me and my friend Lucy banned from playing the game again. She didn't talk to me for half a year.
And it never worked again.
OK, killed it. Like, it's dead now. There's a big red button, and she said, never push the big red button. It's very tempting.
And I'd signed this up saying, please do not press the big red button again.
I'm pretty sure she couldn't get it to turn back on, so I probably fired something.
Yeah, so it was an acorn, and it was made by the Acorn Company. The BBC didn't actually make them themselves. And the acorn, the A from acorn, is from ARM, Acorn Risk Machines. That's where they started.
So the one before the 90s, you were on the BBC computer. Because this comes from that scheme. So Ken was actually a teacher. And this is Mr. Dondelson. So he lived in the town, the village of Dondelson. I hope I'm saying that right, or they'll be angry with me. So Ken was actually a teacher at the local school. Surprisingly, not a history or English teacher, which we'll get to. And he took it home, and one day he decided to leave his computer on and went out to the pub, leaving his tenant behind, suspiciously. And when he came back, he found some strange messages on his computer, and it got pretty insane over time, and he got more and more messages. But what he generally believed, or is written in his lovely book, is he says that he left the text editor on the screen, left the computer on, went out, it's not connected to the internet. He's come back and he's found some saved file on it, which is quite concerning, with some really bizarre poetry, which is strange. And he left Nick behind. So Nick is his housemate. And he's opened it up on his Edward. That's the text editor, which is a bit strange. So I'm going to read the first message because it's all a little bit strange. So he comes home from the pub and he finds a text document. And it says, true are the nightmares of a person that fears, / safe are the bodies of the silent world, another / turn, pretty flower, turn towards the sun, for you shall grow and sow, another / like a coda, but the flower reaches too high and withers in the burning light, that's another / there, get out your bricks, / pussycat went to London to seek fame and fortune, / faith must not be lost, for this shall be your redeemer.
Oh, I'm getting a chill. While you were reading that, there was a strange noise I heard on the microphone.
Oh my God, really?
I think it's because we're using phantom power.
God, I mustn't have my faith. I'll be lost. But this is so strange, right? So Ken comes home and claims that he read it and was like, it's a ghost. Straight off the bat, like, it's got to be a ghost. Look at this. It's such strange text.
And where was his mate while he was getting pissed up at the pub?
Nick, his adult guy Nick, he lived with, claimed that he was actually out of the house at the time.
Okay.
It's interesting because I actually watched a thing about that and Nick claims that he didn't witness any of this shit at all. What? I actually heard him on another podcast go, I don't know what the fuck they were on about. Like, I don't know what they were on about. Oh. I didn't see ghosts. There were no messages. There were no weird footprints.
Well, I don't spoil it. So what kind of paranormal hypothesis have we got here, if there is such a thing? Is it telekinesis, some kind of projection of force onto the keyboards? Because those are pretty hard to move, those old BBC Model B ones. You know, they're full travel, cherry-type magnetic reed switch keyboards, right? They're not like those slim, sexy Mac keyboards where you just sneeze and type a whole essay. So I think it would take a very powerful spirit to be able to, you know, type a whole message.
Well, according to a character later introduced called Lucas and another one called 2109, they are able to... 2109 dropped off some sort of future computer in a guy from the 16th century's house, and he imagines it in his head and the computer types the messages for him. So that's Ken's book version of events there. And there are actually two other theories of how it's done. And I did a simple Google search and I can probably tell you how it's done. It's quite ruining it. I am ruining it. I'm sorry. I know you're so like, is it? I'm up for this.
Well, no. I'm just trying to remain open-minded and consider all the ideas. I mean, sure. If you were a ghost, if you were trying to communicate with the living or people in a different time, which is what I think your story suggests.
Right.
Well, okay. Well, in Ghosts, you know, I'm talking about the TV show now. Is it the US or the British version? No, I can't remember. Anyway, the disgraced politician guy.
Oh, that's
the one with no
British
pants.
One, yeah.
Well, he can actually type stuff onto the laptop.
Oh, with his mind. And he can only do like three keys at a time or something.
Yeah, it uses up all of his psychic energy to do it. But he can actually press the keys. So I presume the producers of that program must have done good research, and that kind of proves it. It's possible. I mean, that ghosts can press keyboards, right? I mean, at least in that show. What do you think?
I mean, there was an investigation by the Parapsychological Society. I mean, they had a foolproof test that, again, the Google search may have ruined. But, I mean, this gets weird. There ends up being 158 messages. So he gives the machine back to the school. No issues for a whole year. No ghosts. All good. Borrows the computer again and thinks, well, I'll leave it on and see if I get anything weird come through. I want another poem. And instead, he gets a... I write on the behalf of many. What strange words you speak. You are a worthy, in brackets, which is strange for a 16th century man, but I won't argue, good man who has a fanciful woman, and you live in my house, who dwell in my home, with light which the devil makes. It was a great time to have stolen, bribed my house. Signed, ooh, L. Dot Dot.
I felt another ice cube sliding down my back while you were reading that.
It's terrifying, isn't it? So this guy goes on to say that his name is Lucas, and he's upset. He's upset about Ken and Debbie because they've moved into the house. They've stolen everything from him. He's claiming he's called Lewis. It goes on to say that he's actually from 1571, around that time. Do you know what's quite worrying? Is that actually he claims that later on his name is Thomas Harden, and he was actually alive during the 1550s, as far as we know. So it's not like, you know, that's a public record. It is a public record. So later on, Lewis changes his name, much later on. Funnily enough, after a historian gets involved, he changes his name to Thomas Harden. Harden, I know, it's quite surprising, isn't it? But this was a vicar. So he's actually claiming that he was using a false name intentionally later on. But Lewis is actually the vicar Thomas Harden, who did exist. But again, this doesn't change until a historian comes into the picture. So there's some strange things going on. So obviously, they have a bit of a back and forth. Ken goes and gets some friends from the local school, one of them which is a historian. And actually straight away, one of his friends, who's like an English teacher, points out that the language that's used is not quite right. There's some modern words in there. Definitely wouldn't have been around in that time period. So he's a little bit more sceptic. And we have strange messages. So I'm going to read just a couple of the messages to show you how this is progressing. So he just sends a random one. I found a picture of the cart, but it is a crude thing, for without the horse, it won't go far. That's it, just that. So it became quite interesting, I guess. But then, obviously, didn't get enough information. So suddenly, in 1985, they get a message from someone called 2109, which is a bit strange. So what 2109 claims is that they're actually a time traveller, and that by meddling and questioning them, they're actually going to ruin the future. And that he actually goes on to say that he gave the 16th century man a machine.
Well, yeah, I mean, he could be right. We're in the future now. This is the future. And it's pretty messed up.
I mean, that's very, very true. So, I mean, he started to say things like, try to understand that you three have a purpose that shall in your lifetime change the face of history. We, 2109, must not affect your thoughts directly, but give you some sort of guidance that will allow room for your own destiny. All we can say is that we are all part of the same God, whatever he is.
Yeah, well, that all makes perfect sense, yeah.
Totally, totally sense. So they start having a conversation back and forth with all three of these characters, and it goes on for a really, really long time. And in the end, Ken gets a bit upset because Debbie, his wife, claims that she saw 6-foot-high pile of furniture tossed into the corner of a room as if a giant had done it. She found words on walls and walking and feet impressions, some of which they do have some sort of photographic evidence of, just as like things piled up, you know, that sort of usual paranormal evidence that we get. Debbie claims that her house as well was on ley lines, and as a result of these ghostly computer messages, she was having visions and receiving telecommunications to her brain directly from some of these ghosts or time travelers. So Ken went to the Society for Psychical Research for help and fame, Stella's book. So he actually got two guys to come into the property called John Bucknell and John Wench. They couldn't find anything in the house, no signs of any paranormal activity. So they decided, because of course they were fantastic, phenomenal computer scientists in 1985 at this society, that the best way to test to see whether it was Ken, Debbie or Nick, or any of the other guys involved that were reading his two friends, they would create 10 questions in Edward and leave it on the computer and then leave the computer on.
Very clever.
Very clever. And they made sure that Ken and Nick and Debbie and everybody else was not in the room, and the questions were destroyed afterwards. After they left the 10 questions on the machine for a few minutes, they then deleted the file and then waited for an answer. And guess what?
What?
An answer came back.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
Now, they didn't directly answer the questions. He actually got really upset with meddling and said, "The future is at risk, how dare you? Trying to trick me with deleting files." But he actually went on 2109 to answer some of the questions that were asked to them, or at least in some sort of code, almost as if they had retrieved back some of the data. So I guess this is sort of where this story goes into our world, isn't it? Because one theory that they didn't come up with in all of this was that data is not often deleted, is actually retrievable. However, they did come up with some pretty out there sort of ideas as to how this could have been done by hacking the computer, how this was falsified. So there was one idea that SPR mics could have been used in a side channel attack, so they could have picked up the typing sounds if he'd hidden really powerful mics in the room at the time, which is a theory that we can discuss in a minute, but it's likely. There's also another one where they suggested that they'd stolen the earth wire from the machine, and if they were using it to get the electrical impulses from the computer, so sort of like a LAN signal, not very likely during that time period on a BBC. So I think that we can probably rule that one out. There are two more theories. So the other theory that obviously has some weight behind it is the side channel attack. So I think we should have a little chat about that before I give you my theory that I've managed to find from a Google search. So, Andy, side channel attack using microphones. Is it possible with a BBC Model B to pick up different type key sounds? Like, are they different, or is it just the same clunk?
Yeah, those keys are kind of quite unique. The resonances for them would be discernible, but you know, not in 1985, I don't think. Not with the kind of digital signal processing around then. The kind of techniques that you need to turn that sound, even from a fairly good recording, into a text. That kind of thing is only just possible right now. But the Tempest attack, absolutely yes. I mean, I've seen that even back in the sort of 90s. If you've got a couple of cables running next to each other that are not shielded, you can literally see on your screen a kind of ghostly, wavy version of what's on your neighbour's screen. I mean, just because of the electromagnetic radiation, it just jumps across the cables.
They weren't in the house at the time and there was no internet, so... And I don't know how they would have stored that sort of Tempest data coming through.
Well, I'm still just trying to look at this from the attacker's, I mean, the ghost's point of view here. you know, if you're able to travel in time and space and influence electrons and electromagnetic fields, why does this require an elaborate explanation? Surely you could just kind of telekinetically write the data to disk.
I mean, according to Canon in his book, they were genuine spirits, right? And that all these messages were real right up until they just stopped, essentially. But what a lot of, you know, our skeptical people like myself have worked out is that it was probably just the computer.
Or that they made up the entire thing completely.
Yeah, totally. And I'll tell you why. Because when I did a Google search, I looked to see if data was recoverable on a Model B BBC computer. And yeah, totally. There are actually three methods, most of which are really simple. For example, you just boot the machine up and then you press two keys, the shortcut key. Can't remember what they were. You can Google it yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. You just press two on the boot screen and it'll go, "Oh, do you want to recover the data that was deleted?" And you go, "Yeah, okay." And it actually gives you three instructions as to how to get it, including instructions of how to get back text documents that you've lost on Edward if you have a like power loss, brownout, anything like that. I mean, that would have been happening to people using these who are actually using them for work documents. So, of course, there's a workaround. It actually is some of the technology that we use today.
Yeah, Norton Ghost.
And of course, you are, with that machine, you are taking out disks. Every time you want to use the software, it's almost like the old Sega drives and things where you have to put your cartridge in. It's very similar to that. So if you want to use Edward, you have to grab the software floppy drive, pop it in, and it's run off that drive and it's written to and from your hard drive. And I'd imagine that it's also keeping some of that data on the drive that you're putting in as well, because one of the three methods is to try and get it back through there as well. So that, I mean, I generally think that if their only test to see if Ken was part of it was about some deleted questions that managed to answer, pretty sure we've just come up with three legitimate reasons as to why that's probably not a ghost. Just gonna throw that in there. Wasn't exactly the most thorough investigation. It has had a lot since. And like I said, there's hundreds and hundreds of hours of this online. And there are so many comments from people going, yeah, it's totally real. It's totally real. I can't believe it. I wonder what those three had to do. Maybe it was tell us everything. But we have had some experts look at the emails or the messages that have come through.
Sure. GCHQ had some spooks looking at it, right?
Yeah, just for the paper, really. And they're English experts, Latin experts, historical experts. And they've said that none of this is correct. All the historical facts are out, as in, they're not correct at all. The dates are completely wrong. I mean, claims at one point, I think they were seeing a Shakespeare play, but it wasn't written for 50 years before that. You know, it was written 50 years after they claimed to see it. So it's ridiculous. You know, Shakespeare's not born yet. And then the language is ridiculous. So they would all have spoken really with Latin at that period. That's what they would have typed in. How on earth has a man who's never spoken modern English typing in modern English and also knows to put things like slashes and
lols, you know, like LOL,
punctuation, modern punctuation,
Google Translate,
things like that. Yeah. And there's a load of words as well that were only invented as well, that a professor of English worked out that there's a lot of modern words in there that wouldn't have been invented. So their prediction was that this person's come from the 20th century who wrote the messages. Mm.
The language experts could use spectral analysis.
I think, of course they did. You have to when it's a ghost story, don't you?
It totally, yeah.
So has it left any room for you that this is a ghost story, or is this a hack? I feel sorry for Nick. Do you know what? I feel so sorry for Nick, because Nick had to... So it was on Unexplained Mysteries on Netflix recently, so it got this huge sudden viral following, and poor Nick was made to answer, and he was just like, dude, stop asking me. Yeah, I lived in this house for like 8 months. I was a musician. I was down the pub like a lot, and I didn't see anything, all right? I don't know anything about these messages.
I don't know any of that. We were doing a lot of drugs at the time.
Think so, like, clearly. And he was like, oh, sometimes my musician friends came around, like, I don't know what they were always doing all the time. So it's like,
okay, well, let's leave a little bit of room for some mystery there. I mean, that's a great story, Helen. I'm glad you brought that one, but let's be open-minded, huh? Okay, brilliant. Well, let's leave a little bit of room for some mystery there, huh? Maybe some of our listeners will get in touch and let us know what they think, and maybe they've got a few haunted computers around.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they've got a haunted computer that's a bit more, you know, less debunkable. That would be what I'm looking for, really, is that if you generally have a computer device and you generally think, especially if you're an expert, that this thing has to be haunted, we will, as a team, fly wherever you tell us. You will have to pay the flight. But we will fly around the world and we will come and check out your computer, and we will...
Put Wireshark on it and try to figure out who's messing with your head.
There's probably a lot more haunted computers since the internet came online.
I think you're right, and there has been a massive increase in the number of devices getting possessed by mischievous spirits lately.
That's true.
People think that they own their phones and their tablets and their devices, but they don't really know what's living inside that and what forces are in control of it.
I mean, that's quite true. If you look at the COVID vaccination, I mean, they used our microprocessors of everyone's mobile phones while they were sleeping in the West. And people are still angry when you say to people, do you know how they crunch through the data? It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not some weird, unsafe jab. It's just that they crunched through 5 years of data in a very small time. They go, how'd they do it? They go, oh, they used your microprocessor when you had it on charge. And they go, what? but that costs me electric. And they can't just access my device whenever they want. It's like, oh, no, but you don't own that. What do you mean I don't own it? Well, you own, like, the case, the plastic case, and maybe some glass, but anything inside and the software you don't own, that's someone else's property, and they can do what the hell they want to it.
Yeah, that is very interesting. I was recently revisiting some early cyber law and looking at the Computer Misuse Act again.
Okay.
And that's an interesting thing that happened. It's actually in Australia back in the end of the 80s, I guess. So you can read about that in a book called The Hacker Crackdown. If I remember rightly, that's by a guy called Bruce Sterling. And it was all about the very first prosecution of a hacker. And the judges were absolutely confounded. They didn't understand how, I mean, how could you break into a computer? What did that even mean? Is that possible? And so the very first prosecution actually happened for the crime of stealing electricity. It was the phone company that brought the charges because, you know, you had to dial in. And so there was an ostensible theft of resources.
Amazing.
And that's still, to this day, the foundational basis of most cyber law is the misappropriation of resources and the harm that's done to the owner of that device.
But, I mean, if you're running a botnet, that's quite a lot of electricity, actually. That deserves an extra charge today.
But obviously, big tech just, you know, is immune to that. It steals your data, uses your device for its own profitable capers, and really that boundary of ownership has completely disappeared for the individual. So there's kind of one law for one and a different law for others. Corporate entities and government agencies and whatever, they get the full protection of the law, whereas you don't get any at all. I mean, and big tech constantly lies to you about the privacy settings on your phone and what it's capable of doing.
Or if you're running a Bitcoin miner, the amount of data and electricity you're costing data centers is really criminal, actually.
Sure, absolutely criminal. And if you're training your AI on the words and blogs and creative music or outputs of millions of people, that's also criminal. And you know, Hollywood and the publishers, they don't think that's right. But again, one rule for one rule for another.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity.
Talking of data theft, we're going to move on to Random and Nautica. So I was alerted to this by our... We actually now have a conspiracy correspondent. Yes, and at some point, it's someone who used to believe in a lot of conspiracy theories and then kind of got to a good health
state of mental
what health. What was I doing? I'm going to stop drinking as much and just not do that anymore. So I would say they're a reformed conspiracy theorist. So they're a great person. They know loads. They know loads of weird things. So they're a great correspondent to have. And they actually pointed me out to this app, this spooky app called Random Nautica, which is meant to be, I wouldn't say haunted, but it's supposed to be God's willed or your willed, you know. So I said it in the introduction. It's an app that uses quantum computing power to send you on a random adventure.
There's no earthly way of knowing which direction we are going. There's no knowing where we're rowing.
Now, according to the lovely little PR video that I watched, and if you go to their website, they will tell you that this is a spiritual journey, that, yes, they use computer technology, but it's quantum technology. So what we're doing is we're thinking of an intention for a few minutes until your phone tells you it's safe, that it's found on your spot. You're thinking of your intention. What adventure do you want? Do you want a happy one? Do you want a horrible one? What do you want to see? And then it will say things like, the universe will give you your wish, but it won't do it in the way you think it will do it. And what our app will do is put you in a situation, if you think it right, if you do it right, it will allow a random coincidence or a strange situation to happen. And that is the purpose of the app. And that's the adventure.
Jimmy Reckon.
I can't believe it. It's like a dream. What's wrong?
I just had a terrible thought. What if this is a dream?
Well, then kiss me quick before you wake up.
And if you go online, you will see hundreds and hundreds of hours of people filming themselves doing this app. There are videos of 10 most dangerous things that people have found playing the app. And people generally think that this app is some sort of quantum spooky, magical physics kind of thing from a sci-fi that is sending you to places that you have dreamed up in some way. What do you think about that one?
I can't see any downsides at all, or imagine anything that could possibly go wrong.
I mean, as we were only at a conference about that recently, but I really don't think it can do that. I don't think it can do a lot at the moment, actually, quantum computing. I think really it's just speeding up computation power,
for a small
it?
Class of problems.
Faster, better.
Stronger, faster.
Well, I don't think it has the ability to read your mind and send you to a strange location of the exact intention you had. And I'm not sure why a bunch of American teenagers would want to find dead bodies or would want to put themselves in some sort of crime in the middle of the desert where they were told to leave very angrily. Very strange.
Yeah, this kind of geolocation stuff, it's all a bit Black Mirror, isn't it? Whoever owns and runs that application can send you off on whatever crazy full mission that they like, off to be the patsy or the stooge at the scene of some crime or whatever.
Exactly. And that's what I really wanted to discuss. So I looked into this and straight away I'm laughing because I know that it probably is either random or they're doing something exactly like you just said, like listening to police radios or keeping in touch with local news and then sending people out to that place. So I decided to actually see if I can find the source code. And I'm sorry, Random Nautica, if you do find this, but your source code has been leaked. It's not by myself. You'll find it on GitHub. Everyone can now find it on GitHub. Someone's leaked it. And there's lots of comments by other software developers who've looked through it. I looked through it myself. There's nothing weird in there. But what I did notice is there's a lot of data harvesting and access to large data marketers at the beginning when you take your app online.
Oh, Helen, you have to spoil everything. Why can't it be some kind of Panglossian best of all possible worlds with the universe balancing the yin and yang through a kind of karmic equilibrium? You ruin everything.
When you sign up for the app, they've got quite a scary data policy here, which basically says they do use... I'll actually read it.
Floods, fire, frost, of frippery.
Accidents? What kind of accidents?
I didn't know we had to sign anything for this.
I can't see what it says in the bottom.
What's this all about?
Standard form of contract.
Don't talk to me about contracts, Wonka. I use them myself. They're strictly for suckers.
Give me that pen.
Absolutely. And I believe that when you're thinking of your intention, that's what's going on, isn't it, behind the background, is you've already given them all of your stuff. The computer, the lovely little big computer, I doubt it's a quantum computer. I'd like to see a picture of it because there's not many and they're very expensive to run. This app doesn't look particularly wealthy. I'd imagine it's just a nice big computer server rack, got a good amount of data flow because they're going to need it, because they're going to need to be doing quite a lot of calls out to a lot of the marketers to receive information about the person. And they're also going through and taking everything they can off that person's device, right?
It's definitely appropriate for the show because it sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It potentially could be a nightmare. And I generally think that that's what's going on, is that it's not reading your intention. It's putting you into some sort of personality category, isn't it? And it's working out if maybe you've got a following, for example, on YouTube, and that you might be doing this for some sort of channel, in which case it's going to do a little bit more work to make it look like their app is generally what they're selling and not some mass data harvesting tool. There is actually somewhere in it that says that they can do whatever they want with the data that they gather as well, which is quite concerning.
Well, I guess the most important piece of information there is that you are the kind of person who'll go off to some random location on the basis of a woo-woo quantum computer.
You obviously don't know anything about quantum computing. Generally, to think that you're communicating with the universe because a computer is called quantum is, I guess, what the story is really about, because it's people's confusion or lack of understanding of the devices that could be in their homes in the next 10 years.
But why do people want to communicate with the universe? I mean, you're communicating with the universe just by sitting in your chair. I mean, that's physics, right?
So it's a lack of understanding that...
Tapping into some kind of desire. I'm just wondering what it's hooking into, you know, the psychology of it. People are looking for what? A chance encounter, a way out of boredom, I mean, what are they looking for?
They're looking for God, really. They're looking for God in a society, and then a lot of them are young, and I would imagine that it's something that they're not really into.
Yeah, but if it sends them off down a railway line or into a minefield or whatever, then they're going to find God, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's what some of these people are doing, mad things.
Much sooner than God had planned.
There are stories of people turning up to live shootings. It's like, if it sends you to the bad part of town at 2 a.m, where there are regular shootings, why would you go there and then be surprised that there's a shooting? There's a software now, I can't remember where in America it is, you're more than welcome to write in views. There is a state where they are able, it might be Cleveland, but they're able to predict based on data of previous crimes. So they know, for example, that between 2:30 and 3 o'clock, this street's got a 95% chance of a death occurring. So they'll send paramedics and police around the corner in anticipation that's going to happen. I mean, that is just the data world that we live in, isn't it?
Well, it's a particular way of using data. It's a data world that creates positive feedback loops and self-fulfilling prophecies and reinforcement.
I think it's being run by like the paramedic system, so hopefully it's not. But it's quite interesting that they can predict where resources are needed. I guess that's what they're doing. They're not just predicting crime. They're predicting what resources are needed, and they're letting the computer help them to make the most of those resources. But that's using like this a mass amount of data. So if you think that a whole city can do that and use its resources better, then of course this app can do that with all the data it gets from you.
But I still don't understand the desired outcome. I mean, what is it that people are expecting to get out of this as a result?
Oh, so they want to be sent somewhere to have a spooky, weird experience. So it will send them to dangerous places because more chance of a spooky experience.
Yeah, it's a good bit of fun. I guess it's a modern version of The Dice Man for people who've never read Reinhardt. But I do worry that that'll end in tears. And what bugs me most of all is the cheap profiteering out of people's loneliness and gullibility and boredom. But then hucksters and mediums and cold readers, and those guys have always done that. It's a very old industry.
So there's another part of this as well that we need to discuss with all apps. Is it says it has the right to sell this app or change its use or its privacy settings at any time. And of course, this is what apps that we know about have done all the time. They can be sold to bad guys. They can be sold to threat actors. They can also change all of the settings and make them completely wide open. But they don't actually have to notify you potentially of an update if you're still using the app. And most people don't read them. They'll just click them. So you may take an app from the app store and think, oh, this is okay. And you do your due diligence and you check it. But you don't know if a year later.
Yeah, sure. That kind of thing's been going on for a long time with things like web browser plugins. And there's a whole attack surface there, a mechanism whereby which people set up a company, build an application, start trading it, but they're doing so with the sole intention that later on they're going to use the Silicon Valley tech bro language. They're going to pivot. In other words, they're going to then sell that accumulated user base. You know, you are the product. They sell that user base onto somebody who's going to exploit them. And that happens with a little switcheroo behind the scenes when the terms and conditions just change. And suddenly you're not in Kansas anymore, but you don't know that the app that you installed has become treacherous. So it's a real bait and switch. And it's very common.
And this is very much targeted at a specific audience. So this is a lot of Alpha Gen and Gen Zs that are doing this. And they're very young, you know, young people that... And it's sold at a younger market as well. And it's really about, you know, we are building AI models. If you're downloading this app and you're using it, you're potentially feeding that AI model everything about yourself. There's a couple that online on a video I saw, they were clearly discussing what they wanted to see, and then they were taken just there. So it's a situation where they have the right to do all of that, to access all of your stuff, and all the third parties can. Yeah, they can generally record your conversation and then use that to send you exactly where you wanted. And they're not the only app that can do that. Any app can do that. It's the apps you've got that are accessing your microphone or your camera. And you'd be surprised because some of them are like text-based.
Well, again, I think it's an old problem in a new skin. When I used to roll with the humanists and rationalists and skeptic society and stuff like that, we talked about this kind of thing all the time. There was this guy called James Randi. He was a ferocious debunker. And he used to give lectures all of the time and talked a lot about preying on people's emotions and gullibility. In fact, there was loads of laws passed to counter spiritualism. So it's an old thing, but combining that with technology It's a new and dangerous brew, I think.
And targeting one specific youth market whose parents have been really, really keen on, actually for the first time, of really protecting their data. And it's, we're going to, I think, see more things like this come out where it's aimed at teenagers and cool people. It's just a bit of fun. You know, TikTok's a great example of that. Temu's another example of that, where they're actually apps designed to steal your data and are incredibly addictive. But we're not able to piece that together. We'd rather go into the mystical and the madness because I guess we're all a bit lonely and bored.
Well, that kind of makes it sound a bit too much like there's a genuine product there pandering to a market. And I think the reality is a lot darker than that. A lot of the corporations that make these kind of things hire some of the best psychology PhDs around. And there's an extensive literature on dark patterns, you know, ways of designing these apps to hook people and to press their buttons around superstition and so on. And it's not just that these apps suck people into parting with their data and their money, but it's that there's something profoundly dishonest about the way that this damages computing, the way that it damages people's understanding of technology, and the way that it kind of undermines their positive relations with technology as an understandable utility, you know. It's a real intellectual debasement.
So they're designed with a different intention to the one that they're marketed towards. So, you know, I've been in situations like that where they go, well, we want this app for this reason. So this is the outcome that we want. This is how much data we need to harvest. This is how much money that data will make us. And we need you, psychologists and youthful people and media experts, to design an app that will basically get us that data. And I generally feel that that's where the intention for an app like this comes from, is it comes from, we want to get this data from these people. You guys work out how best to do that within the bounds of law.
Oh, and well beyond the law. I know fellow computer scientists, psychologists, obviously I can't say any more, but, you know, they've been approached to make these kinds of products. And, well, yeah, to their credit, they said no, just off. Because the things they've been asked to do are clearly very, very unethical and almost certainly illegal, especially in light of the new European laws that have been coming in the last few years. But even if those laws didn't exist, I mean, your basic common sense and conscience tells you no.
But someone says, yeah, right, all these apps wouldn't exist. And that's, you know, that comes back to you. Education, which is where this goes again, you know, when we need to make sure, we're really good at doing this in England, I think it's great, and we really make sure that ethics in situations like that, with computer science, with psychology, with medical science, everything, with research as well, we really make sure that the ethics is the first and most important thing before we go any further. That's the first thing you put down.
Yeah, well, you say that, and I know that the BCS are very, very good on ethics, but the whole of the UK, I don't know. Look at the scandal of the NHS just selling all the medical data to Google and completely reversing everybody's very clearly stated choices to opt out of that. I mean, that was an absolute scandal.
Because if you're behind in the research or you're behind in innovation, you're going to be more inclined to say, we don't really mind.
Yeah, but I don't really think that that cuts it. Behind in what? It's like a kind of Doctor Strangelovian, we have to close the lack of privacy gap to compete in the global market, that kind of thinking. Research isn't a good enough reason to throw all your values under a bus as soon as it's convenient. And just the idea that because you know a bit about technology, it's okay to trick people and to gaslight them, that's despicable.
As our technology advances, as we especially go into the world of AI, people are, generally people who are not in computing, are becoming so distant from the technology we're using in their understanding that it does become magic. It's almost like we're going back to the time of shamans where the thunder is the voice of God and we do a rain dance for the rains. It's almost going back to that because our technology, to some people, is so advanced, it's alien. And that needs to change because we can't live in a wild society where half the population of the world see it as completely alien and not something that they can deal with or understand, but it's just something they have to use. We do need a very good basic, and it needs to be a lot quicker with the way our technology is going, is that when the technology is coming out and it's in society, everyone should be getting some sort of training and education on what that is and how it works.
Yeah, I think that's a nice sentiment. And all of us here believe that on the Cyber Show and the work we do with Boudica, that education is the bedrock of literate society, you know, that we champion civic cybersecurity and understanding and so on. But of course, we all know that it's massively to the advantage of the vendors, people who make devices and technology, that people remain uneducated and largely ignorant about how it works. It takes a brave and resourceful government to step up to that challenge. But we got to get back to the haunting. We're here to talk about derelict houses and cobwebs, not derelict government. So, you know, I think Ed's just joining us. One of the things I've been wanting to get into on this episode was, it's a strange language of Unix. Maybe we can talk about daemons and zombie processes a little bit. Like, why are the default UMASK file permissions 666?
Because IT people are freaking weird and we all like metal. We know this. He's laughing. That's true. Most of us do. We're the weird kids that play video games. I was doing a lesson the other day and saying, you can just go through commands, press the up and you get back your commands. And I just installed GIMP for work. But obviously that command seemed quite inappropriate.
Yeah, GIMP does seem to raise a few eyebrows.
Yeah, it definitely does. If they don't know that, that's it's basically PaintShop Pro for free.
It's like GNU image processing program.
But it says that I have now completed unpacking GIMP. And they're like, what? Don't worry, it's not what you think.
So a really improbable acronym that I heard the other day for daemon was that it actually once stood for a disk and execution monitor. I find that a bit hard to believe.
No, someone else has just made that up afterwards as an excuse because they're now like 70. It's like my dad. I'm like, hey, how do you feel like, you know, naming a load of stuff in the programming world? Do you guys ever regret some of the names you chose? And he's like, yeah, especially when your daughters start saying it. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you do. But that generation, they were just like playing Tomb Raider and were just like high all the time because it was the 90s. They're like, yeah, I called it penetration testing. What, system testing would have been better, but no. And I generally think that was happening. They thought, it's just 8 of us, right? This is not going to take off. Let's just have some fun with it. And now those are set in stone and millions of people are using it.